Hey, what is going on? It is Crypto Bobby, and today I have an awesome conversation for you lined up. It is with Travis Kling and Greg Rocco, both of whom are significantly smarter than me when it comes to crypto research, valuation, understanding token economics. We covered a ton of awesome content in this discussion. Travis and Rocco have very different backgrounds, but have really solid, interesting perspectives. Travis has worked in the traditional financial world for over 10 years as a portfolio manager at Point72 and in the oil and gas trading world as well. And then Greg has been kind of grassroots in the crypto space, is responsible for pretty much half my portfolio growth in 2017 with the old Cardano tip at 3 cents. So shout out to Rocco for that. But without further ado, let's hop into this conversation where we talk all about crypto valuation, institutional investment, retail investors, token economics, token structure, a lot of really good content. Let's go. Thanks so much for taking the time to join, guys. Really do appreciate it. Travis and Rocco, what is going on? Travis, if you wouldn't mind just kicking things off with an introduction as far as kind of your personal background and how you got into this crypto game, and then we'll pass it over to Rocco and dive into everything.
Sounds good. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me, Bobby. So I've been out of school for 10 years, and 9.5 of that was in energy investing. So I was at a hedge fund called Magnetar Capital in Chicago for 4.5 years doing energy long short and non-control private equity and debt, kind of up and down the capital structure, broad investment mandate, long investment horizon, highly liquid or completely illiquid securities. I was there from 2011 through the middle of 15, so it was kind of the go-go years in the oil and gas. So when I joined, the energy business at Magnetar was managing $250 million. When I left, we were managing $4.6 billion, so I had this pretty massive AUM growth over that period of time. Then I left in the middle of 15 and went to Point72, Steve Cohen's hedge fund, where I was running a $200 million long short equities book, a little bit of commodity, a little bit of options. I'm not really a tech guy. I'm not an early adopter guy. I'm not like a futurist kind of guy. So when I first saw Bitcoin or read about Bitcoin when Silk Road got shut down, it's really just from a fascination perspective more than anything. Like, look at these crazy drug dealers that made this magic internet money to go buy drugs on the internet. And when Mt. Gox got hacked, it was sort of confirmation to me that this wasn't really an investable asset class, because like I didn't have any way to try and mitigate or price in the risk that I was going to wake up and somebody like stole all my stuff. So I didn't pay too much of it, more attention to it after that. Fast forward a couple years, back part of 2016. The price started moving again, started paying more attention to it. Spring of 17 with Ethereum and all the ICOs doing their thing, started reading more about it. And then last summer, I just kind of came into work one day and stopped doing my job and just like fell completely down this rabbit hole. And I would like sit in my office and read about crypto all day and then go to the gym and listen to a crypto podcast and then go home and sit on the couch in the dark and read more about crypto.
Yeah, don't tell Oracle I did that too.
Yeah, so I kind of like swan dived down this rabbit hole, probably spent 400 hours doing self-study. Cool thing about it was by the time summer 17 rolled around, there was like such a wealth of knowledge available on the internet for free that like all these concepts that I like didn't really have that good of an understanding on, you could just like dive all the way down and get a good understanding of it. And kind of 400 hours later or so, I came out of that and went to senior management at the end of September of Point72. And I was like, look, this thing is going to be completely revolutionary. It's a once in a generation type of deal. And I don't want to be an equity long short portfolio manager anymore. I'm ready to make a career change. And I told them that under the context, assuming it was going to mean I was going to leave the firm, which I was ready to do. And stuck around for another couple months and had conversations with them about what a crypto business would look like inside Point72. Firm made the decision that they weren't ready to make a formal move into the space at that time. Totally get it. Left the first week of December, left on great terms with those guys, and started exploring the space. And I think when I first left, I was not dead set on starting my own fund. Coming from the traditional hedge fund investing space, starting your own fund is a monumental pain in the ass. And reading CB Insights and Autonomous Next They're saying that there had been 200 and something crypto funds raised in the last 24 months. So I thought, well, I must be kind of late to this party. But as I started going further into the ecosystem, meeting these fund managers and different people that were investing in the space, it immediately became apparent to me that there was a pretty severe lack of institutional grade investment sophistication that was being deployed into this asset class, right? For sure. And the types of things that I think I took for granted coming out of two world-class hedge funds from an investment strategy, process, tool, framework perspective, just by and large, we're not getting sort of executed at any large scale in this emerging asset class. And so that looked like opportunity to me. So I started having conversations with two guys, my two partners, about what it would look like if we raised our own crypto fund. Both of my partners are based out of Los Angeles. I was in New York at the time. So I flew out here in February, spent 2 weeks with those guys, really doing kind of multi-day extended sessions, thinking through all the things that you think through when you're considering starting your own fund, and then spending a lot of time with the crypto ecosystem out here. And at the end of those 2 weeks, I felt good enough about it that I went back to New York and put all my stuff in storage and moved out here, which was so I've been out here actually 3 months to the day. So
nice.
And
a lot here, by the way.
Yeah. No, it's quite nice. Right. And we've just been grinding ever since then, putting the investor presentation together, getting all the tools in place, getting the relationships in place with banking and custody and all the things that you got to go do. And so we're planning on launching August 1st with 20 million AUM. We've got a little over half that committed right now. The strategy, the name of the firm is Ikigai Asset Management, ikigai.fund, if you want to go take a look at that. And strategy is 25% of the AUM is dedicated to venture stage pre-ICO investing. And then 75% of the AUM is a long short multi-strat. So liquid hedge fund strategies applied to the crypto asset space. That looks a lot like what I've been doing over the last 7 years. So, yeah.
We'll definitely dive into all that. Cause like you said, like your background, I think, and where a lot of people traditionally, and even some of like the most prominent crypto hedge fund managers or whatever it might be, don't necessarily have a traditional background in finance and trading. So we'll dive into all that too. But Rocco, how about a quick introduction on your end, man?
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks again for having me. Just a quick aside, talking about the fund managers again, I was in San Francisco for Token Fest a couple months ago, and there was someone who didn't even look like he was past 15 years old in a suit comes up to me. He's like, I run this fund. We do pre-ICO investing only. And I was like, the second he said that just brought me back to that moment. But talk about myself for a bit. I kind of entered the space as a little experiment back in 2013, 2014, did the whole Coinbase route. Bought a little bit and then forgot about it for quite some time. Came back around 2015, 2016, started seeing the emergence of some of the newer stuff, Ethereum coming out, started trading for a little bit. I was working in media and doing kind of the dual hat role of an associate producer as well as systems administration and tech. And even though being a humanities guy, I was always kind of interested in learning about the technology and kind of the communications angle of it, kind of explaining to people at a high level, because one of the most important things in the space, especially for investors, is how do you exactly like explain this to someone? Because the learning curve is ridiculous in terms of, investing in general, because everyone can kind of distill stocks and equities and talk about companies. But when you talk about these digital assets, like what's going on? So that's where I figured I'd find my fit. 2016 to 2017, I realized, I wanted to finally get involved in the space, working in the space. I joined InvestFeed actually during their ICO period, helping them out on communications, community, eventually became their editor in chief, running a news arm for them. Started working on a couple other article site news sites, CCN, Bitcoinist. Started working with other projects too on their communication strategy, their token strategy, just constantly learning more about the protocols and tokens that are coming out in space. Left InvestFeed and then joined Augmate, originally as an advisor, but now doing their investor strategy and communications. And soon I'll be joining Token Foundry over at Consensus, working on token design, kind of microeconomics and creating those models that are integral to projects, not just appended payment tokens. So it's been a good ride. I'm just happy. Probably one of the best decisions was finally going into the space and working in the space, because it's really both a sea of information and a cult of personality as well, with like what we're talking about, like fund managers, and what you were saying earlier, like these guys, yes, hundreds of funds, but no one has any real experience. It's so nascent, and it can be seen in that way. But when you finally, you know, hit the people who are, have experience in these fields, who are doing it, you know, they're going to do it right.
Sure. Yeah, that's it's a great point too. And I think, yeah, like having made the move myself personally, obviously working full time in the space now too, it's been such a refreshing change too, to like get the opportunity to talk to so many of the people that are either doing awesome things or maybe not, and just getting the insight into what the not so great aspects of the crypto industry are. But diving into kind of going from there, diving into, I think like the first topic we could touch on is the valuation of cryptocurrency and tokens. And I think you guys both have like kind of unique ways to look at things. And for context, for everybody's watching, if you were here back in November, December, when I bought Cardano the first time at 3 cents, one of the big reasons was Rocco looking right there saying, hey man, you should check out this Cardano thing at 3 cents before it jumped up to a freaking dollar. So that was, I think he was pretty early on, you know, in looking at how to value some of these assets here, and obviously Travis with your background too. So maybe Travis, if you want to kick things off with maybe like the different ways you see sophisticated investors, like how they value this stuff, or is that even really accurately possible at this point?
Yeah, sure. First off, legal counsel tells me that I have to tell everybody this is in no way investment advice. Nothing I say is anything remotely the sort. This is just opinions, thinking out loud. And that being said, it is incredibly early. When you think about crypto asset valuation, I think about it in the context of what are the things that are keeping institutional investors, institutional money, the Fidelities, the Wellingtons, the State Streets, what's keeping that type of money out of this space? And for me, I think it's a few things. It's regulatory, it's custody, it's prime services, and then it's valuation. And you know, regulatory, we're getting clarity on. At the end of the year, I think we'll have a much better sense of what that sort of, where lines are going to get drawn in the sand than we did at the beginning of this year. Everybody and their dog is running as hard as they can at custody, trying to solve that. Tons of people, tons of money is getting thrown at custody. I think you fast forward 12 to 18 months from now, and custody isn't going to be nearly the same type of front burner risk that it is today. Prime services, which custody is kind of like that, but like custody isn't a thing in traditional sort of like hedge fund investing. So prime services, but just like stock lending, being able to short options, a one-stop shop in terms of closing trades and all the back office and this, that, and the other. And then the fourth one, valuation, it's like, okay, if I buy a share of ExxonMobil today, like, how do I think about whether or not I'm paying a lot or little for ExxonMobil if I buy it today? And like in my old line of work, there's like a quiver full of arrows that you can think about in terms of helping frame that valuation discussion. And there's asset metrics, there's cash flow metrics, there's earning metrics, there's growth metrics, there's there's all kinds of like looking at sort of like what industry it's in and like what are the industry dynamics that are going on, supply demand of oil, you know, what that means from a global macro basis. And then even getting further down into that, like if you're more a systematic type of trader, you have multi-factor models, like a bar, a beta multi-factor model, where you start slicing and dicing individual stocks up into the aggregate of their factors. Like, is this a high momentum stock? Is this a high value stock? Is this, these various different multi-factor models. So then you step into crypto assets, and all those things that I just said, they essentially go away. and from an institutional investor perspective, an institutional investor is sitting there left wondering, okay, well, how do I decide whether or not I'm paying a lot or a little for a crypto asset if I buy it today? And so that's where crypto asset valuation comes in. And it's very nascent, but we are trying to sort of get framework around around how to think about that. And there's been sort of a body of work that's been done. Almost all of this has happened in the last year that you can, you know, you can dig in on the internet. And it's like you start off with simple things like total addressable market. Okay, the global aggregate value of gold is $7.75 trillion. So, you know, if Bitcoin gets 10% of the gold market, well, that's like, you know, whatever, $800 billion. And, you know, that's, you know, 3.5 times up from here or whatever. So, okay, that's interesting. Guys have done using either price or market cap as the numerator, and then putting a bunch of things in the denominator to help gauge like activity of the network as a whole. So that can be, you know, transactions per day. That can be a smooth, like average transactions over a trailing 30-day period. You can look at active wallet addresses. People are using things like community vibrancy, which would be like, what's the Telegram channel look like? What's going on in GitHub? GitHub commits, lines of code added, net of lines deleted. All these different things that people are trying to use is like to create these ratios in the same way that I have an EV to EBITDA or a price to earnings or a price to book when I step back into traditional asset investing. And you know, sort of the punchline is that a lot of the data for those numerators, there's noise in the data, and there may be like issues with not having comparable periods where, for example, before January 2018, exchanges weren't batching. And so, and then afterwards they started batching all the transactions together. And so if you look at sort of, you know, what like a transactions per day looked like prior to January and post January, it's really like apples to oranges. And so now you're talking about a data set that's like only good for the last 5 months. And when people look at price to earnings ratios, they look at it for 60 and 70 years in the traditional in traditional markets. So like that gives you a sense of sort of like how early we are from a valuation perspective, but we have to push the conversation forward because it's one of the main gating factors that's keeping institutional money from coming into the space.
Sure. Any thoughts on that, Rocco, or like when you look at maybe how you examine looking at whatever your favorite crypto asset right now, is there anything that you kind of, whether it's a metric or a data point, or is it more on the fundamental side of the house? What do you really look at that helps to kind of give you a little bit of insight when you're making your own decisions?
So yeah, coming from like a non-technical background with trading, it's always been about what, you know, in the beginning, from what the project does, what it's been doing, what's the kind of value it's adding to the ecosystem. And especially kind of how nascent all this is, the one thing I found useful is when Bernanke was working on the J curve for crypto assets and the way kind of the prices come in, where you were talking about Telegram earlier and community being a metric, like that could obviously, you know, have a, again, none of this is investment advice, just put that there as well.
There's an asterisk in the description. It's legally binding.
There you go. you could have, you know, you could have this high speculation value in the beginning that, you know, brings the price up because of a lot, you know, large community activity. And then the reality sinks in and it's like, wait, this actually doesn't do anything at the moment. And you could have all these events like exchange listings and, you know, partnerships, all this kind of progressive kind of, we're moving along with this project, but it could all be thrashed in a day as well.
Yeah.
Speaking like to the institutional question, at the end of the day, nothing is set in stone really in this space. You have all these protocols. So when people kind of talk about the valuations of like dApps or protocols, I think on your Twitter the other day, it was someone talking about Walton Chain. And the guy was like, yeah, you know, we're talking about the issue of scalability. And he's like, you know, Walton's doing that. And I'm like, how often is Walton being used? Has that really been battle tested? Everyone said they solve scalability, but no one's network is really live and being used as heavily as maybe the top couple of coins, talking about Bitcoin, Monero, Ethereum. And looking at these top 10, you know, they're the only networks that are really being used actively outside of trading potentially, where actually value is being sent back and forth.
Yeah.
Value is a tricky game in this space right now. Again, speaking to institutional investors not coming in, it's my currency can do this. Can it really? But again, that's, you know, you got hype cycles to bring the value up first, but then it's going to die down as people realize it doesn't do anything. And then when it actually starts to do something, is that really going to bring the price back up? You know, we could sit all we want about, you know, that this network does this, but will it really drive the price long term, or will someone come in and scoop that value up before they do it? Where I guess this also comes into how do we value currencies versus applications versus protocols?
Sure.
Because each one then has their own subset of ways you can look at it.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah, I think the J curve, I think, is really a really helpful, like, qualitative framework. And shout out to Chris Bernitsky for all the great work that he did.
Seriously. And, like, he started with TAM and then moved on to all this. So he's been excellent in terms. And that's also one other thing too. With this space, the democratizing of information, whereas, you know, traditionally things have been kind of closed off in these reports, you literally have these guys who are posting on Medium that's accessible to anyone to take a look at this information. It's all out there. Anyone can kind of sit down, dig out Medium and Blockchain and Hacker Noon, whoever's posting, you know, about cryptocurrency, and read from these guys. There's no barriers to entry.
Game changer. I think of it as like the Wikipedia approach versus the Encyclopedia Britannica approach.
Bingo. Right?
And but I do like the crypto J curve a lot from a qualitative framework. And it is just this friendly reminder that, like, nobody is using any of this shit yet for what it's actually meant to be used for. It is almost entirely speculation at this point. But that's one of the things that makes this asset class so revolutionary, is that for the first time ever, you have speculators that can stand at T0 and look out into the future and make a bet on what the future value of a technology that derives a significant portion of its value from network effect might be if enough users come to that technology so that it moves up the network effect curve and hits a critical mass where so many people are using it that the sort of, like, the utility provided per user is compelling relative to the status quo. And for the first time ever, speculators via speculating can pull a technology up that curve through the bootstrapping phase into existence. And that's revolutionary. Like, that's, like, never been available before in the history of anything. But the same revolutionary aspect of it also, like, creates these some confusing points that you have to sort of sort through. And one of them is, like, this exchange between the speculator and the user. And again, shout outs to Bernitsky for the foundational work that he did, but, you know, trying to apply MV equals PQ to the crypto asset space, the equation of exchange, doesn't really work. But what it does do is it allowed a spotlight to be shown on the velocity problem. And, right, you can just Google crypto velocity problem and read 5 hours about it if you want to. And the velocity problem stems from, at least partially, the different velocity characteristics of a speculator versus a user. Like, a user just wants to use the thing, right? And he doesn't care about the price going up tomorrow, you know, relative to where he bought it today. But that's what the speculator cares about. And so, like, the same thing that makes this asset, you know, that characteristic makes this asset class revolutionary, also, like, sort of, you have to start thinking through these different steps that you haven't ever had to do with a different asset class before.
Yeah, what's also interesting with the curveball thrown is that you can't quantify everything in this space because of how nascent it is. Yeah. You need the subjective approach. You need that, you know, you need the qualitative approach as well.
Yeah, yep. And that's one thing, Rocco, I feel like you've done pretty, at least I've always noticed, like, you've done a good job of when it comes down to, like, just finding, it seems like you've had a knack for finding information out when it's pretty early on in regards to, not necessarily quantitative data, but something like, you know, some type of event that you feel like is going to draw speculative interest into an asset. Like, for example, like the Z Classic fork into Bitcoin Private, I feel like you were on that pretty damn early, like sub $10 or sub $5 when it ran all the way up to $200-$300. Like, when you look at stuff like that, what, like, where do you find out a lot of that information? Like, how do you source that type of information?
That's all, again, that's all social media. That's Twitter, that's Reddit, that is Telegram groups. Even evaluating that whole thing with Z Classic, it's like, A, look at the volume on it. B, B, you saw, you know, an asset with very low market cap. And again, I'm not one to value assets, you know, you can't always base it on market caps, but it was a time when forking was this hot thing, you know, the dust settled after Bitcoin Gold, but you had a feeling it might've come back on an asset that was that low. And people realized to get a one-to-one value with an asset like Z Classic, that was so, it was like a dollar. It was crazy. You know, people are going to come pouring in to go get that regardless. And that's the problem too. Z Classic was Zcash minus, you know, the founder's award. It literally innovated nothing other than that. There's no magic value to Z Classic, to be completely honest. It was yeah. a piece of crap. But you know that they're going to drive the price up because they want this extra asset. There was no rationale other than getting that asset. It wasn't like you couldn't evaluate it based on network usage if the value was going up. This network wasn't being used at all. I'm wondering how many transactions were actually sent through the Z Classic blockchain that weren't exchange related. Like just applying that, I'm sure, like exactly, like next to nothing. But the value is still driven up by the speculation of I'm going to get this next asset called Bitcoin Private that's going to revolutionize whatever. I don't even know what it does exactly. Like that kind of thinking is what brought it there. The other thing I've used even in the case of Cardano we were talking about earlier, and you realize the thing about Cardano that struck me when it was at that low point when it first released, it was a red herring like a black sheep in the market. It opened at a $500 million cap. So first off, it's like, whoa, you know, nothing has done that before in the market. So it was very strange. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, okay, they've been doing this for years. You know, Hoskinson's been in space since like BitShares. You know, he's working on Ethereum as well, one of the founders. And he's been planning this for years and they're working on future testing something. So I was like, okay, it's a solid bet. But even as simple as that, and then it had its whole entire drive, even though again, Cardano, they're still working on it, still centrally validated. It's nothing like, you know, Ethereum at all, where it's public yet, but it could have this kind of speculative value that people are going to drive it up simply because of what it looks like right now. Again, and no logic, it's slight logic, like it's no market logic.
Yeah.
No traditional market logic.
Raga, I just have a question on Cardano. I listened to, Huskisson on, was he on Epicenter the other day? Which podcast
he was on Epicenter. I think he was talking about governance, and I was just like, you realize how much the guy knows between technical and also democracy and idea.
He's so fire. So my question for you is, how do you feel if you're long Cardano, you're like long the concept of academia actually putting out something that works and happens in real life, which has historically not been like a great to put in that. So I don't know, just curious how you think about how they're going about things there.
It's definitely a crazy calculated approach with them peer reviewing all their papers, building it in Haskell. But I don't think it's, you know, going long on any of these in any individual protocol like that is a smart bet, considering again how early it is. But it's not a bad idea to, because of how irrational things are, to take a gamble on something like that. Again, like you're saying, you know, traditionally evaluating something like that is like almost never done. Like it's not always a good move. But in the crypto markets where nothing makes sense, it might be a good bet. And that's honestly, it's a sick way of seeing it. But it's you have to, I feel like in these markets, what's good that, you know, seasoned fund managers and people, you know, with knowing the traditional markets evaluations are coming in, because now that can meet this irrational exuberance that's happening in the crypto markets and find a healthy medium of you have the battle tested guy mixed with the psycho on Twitter who knows about the events that are going on, or, you know, has this crazy way of evaluating assets, because those can come and meet, really make sense of this entire market.
Yeah. I mean, it probably goes back to just a portfolio management concept, which is like, does Cardano have a place in your portfolio? Like, yeah, for sure. You know, you can talk about what the size of that is going to be, or what your overall exposure to the broader market is going to be.
Again, another note about Cardano is the way we evaluate tokens as a placeholder asset. So Cardano, for example, didn't launch a placeholder asset. When they launched Cardano years after putting development into it, they launched the mainnet asset. Even though Cardano, again, is controlled by central validators, it was still the asset on the Cardano network with the wallet, the Daedalus wallet. You weren't having a placeholder asset like Zilliqa, like Archain, like EOS.
Tron dogs.
Like Tron, exactly. That they released their asset as it was as well. You weren't getting it. It's not an ERC-20 token. So that threw people off as well.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, you know, it's an uncommon thing now to launch a network with the mainnet asset. You have LandChain, you have Icon, you have Aon, all going ERC-20 tokens, because it's easy to have this placeholder asset have a liquidity built in, even though nothing has been launched network-wise publicly.
Yeah. And I think to an extent, being long Cardano is sort of a bet that like all this other stuff like isn't going to work, right? That like Ethereum's Casper isn't going to do what it says it's going to do. You know, EOS is going to have problems. Hashgraph's going to take too long to come out. Lightning Network is going to have it. You know, and it's like
because nothing is future tested.
Yeah.
That's honestly the bet with currencies. You could easily evaluate like Monero, Decred, Bitcoin on their network value, you know, their transaction ratio. But with all these protocols that are going to solve scaling and not just, exist as a medium of exchange, but like, you know, power things on top of it, like smart contracts and you know, save the world with 10 million transactions per second, no one is future tested.
Yeah.
So it's best to be diverse in that area.
Yep. It is that whole like the general purpose platforms or the smart contract platforms or whatever, you know, the hell we want to call them at this point in time. I do think that's one of the more interesting areas to look at, especially when you consider like the disparity between the valuation of Ethereum and then like the EOSs, the Cardanos, the Neos, the whatevers out there, just because of there's a massive delta there. Anything, I guess, when you look at like at those platforms, is there anything in particular, whether it's like the token structure around them, or if there's anything that like makes you just interested when you are looking at one of those that you think might be the winner in this space, or if it's more in the tech side, and be curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. I mean, with those guys with platforms, it's number one, who's going to launch a mainnet, and they could boast all they want, but when, you know, push comes to shove, you know, does it actually work the way it's intended? Right now, I think it's a bet on looking at all these consensus models and who has both. The other interesting thing about this is how do we give up the whole centralization versus decentralization debate? So if you take it's that ethos as well that kind of plays a part. So people have been like harping on Ethereum for being centralized, but you know, our chain has a co-op with a contracted developer arm, Pyrefx, and a venture capital arm, Reflective Ventures. Cardano is under IOHK. Like all these companies that are centralized, even currencies like, you know, Zcash as a foundation. So it's hard to evaluate on that end, but honestly, with all these platforms, it's hard to tell. I think it's honestly just digging into the tech, listening to one important thing is listening to all the naysayers. And if one of them gets a pass by a naysayer, like a good example, I like Jackson Palmer. He's a great guy. He's probably one of my favorites because he'll rip things apart and tell you why it doesn't work. But if we'll something ever slips,
it's the best.
Yeah. But the second Jackson says, wow, this is doing something, because he has a track record of breaking things apart and saying it won't work, that's the guy I'll listen to in terms of like, wow, this might actually have a chance.
Agree with that. All these there's so much shilling going on Twitter, right? It's like you lose so much potency because you pretend like you like everything. And it's like, yeah, it's good to have those opinions. I guess from my perspective, a lot of these debates, you know, whatever, whether it's governance structures, whether it's consensus protocols, proof of work, proof of stake, DPoS, you know, DAGs versus blockchains, gossip about gossip, like all these various different like you know, kind of like qualitative philosophical approaches. Like I'm in a couple of Telegram chats with guys that are so much further down the rabbit hole in that type of stuff than I am. Like, it's like I think of that as like, taking a step back, not to plug Ikigai Asset Management again, but the four foundations that we built our portfolio management strategy on is qualitative research, fundamental valuation, quantitative tools, and event-driven catalysts. A lot of the conversations that we've just been having like around Cardano, that's like qualitative research type of stuff. Talking about the Z Classic and the fork stuff, that's like event-driven catalyst type of stuff. We hit on like total addressable market, modified Metcalfs, J curves. That's like fundamental valuation type of stuff. Quantitative tools, you know, it's like a lot of technical analysis. You can do sentiment analysis. There's more systematic big data harnessing, that kind of thing. So I think of those as the bucket. So going back to the qualitative research bucket, where you're talking about like, you know, comparing sort of like, you know, these like sort of like theoretical, you know, one versus the other, you know, and the trade-offs that happens, scalability trilemma is something that people like to talk about all the time. And like, I'm in sort of like regular discussions with like some of the smartest guys that are putting out work in this. And I can tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt, there is zero consensus about anything in terms of like, there are really smart guys on both sides of the fence of like on every single one of these major issues. And so as a hedge fund bro that like, you know, doesn't have this incredibly deep knowledge on, you know, how all this stuff comes together, I just look at those guys and I go, okay, well, if they can't decide, then apparently it's just not decided yet. So what as an asset allocator and as a fiduciary, what you want to have is to be in a front row seat where you can see all of this playing out in front of you and you can have the clearest vision possible to see as much of the information as it's coming in real time. So that when consensus does start to coalesce around, okay, this looks like this might be the way to go, this looks like it might be the way to go, you see that as early as possible, and then you start allocating capital accordingly.
Yeah, and to talk to that, like even recently, I think vested interests also can cloud that very heavily. So to take a look, I think Kyle Samani from Multicoin recently tweeted about EOS, saying like it had the potential to be like a $500 billion capitalization. I'm saying in my head, that's like ridiculous. And obviously I could tell, you know, as they got closer to mainnet, as people started realizing that DPoS has issues or EOS is going to have issues, that he started tweeting heavier about EOS. And I'm saying to myself, like, you know, you're going to see this craziness even in the groups that you're in because of vested interests. And as networks come out and start to prove themselves, it might only get more crazy. I think a consolidation of this kind of stuff can happen over a couple of years, but even in those groups, all of them have their vested interests in different things. So you're still going to see this mess of my network does this or my network does this or will do this. Because EOS was nothing. I mean, has the mainnet even launched? I know they're still working on bugs. But just to use that as an example, like crazy valuation, the mainnet's not even here yet. And honestly, going back to that, I think one thing that's important too, like I mentioned Jackson earlier, but any Bitcoin maximalists are important to listen to, regardless of, you know, how you feel about them on Twitter or always, you know, talking about everything is garbage. You want those indicators of the second they say something might have potential that is worth way more than 150 people in alternative crypto assets talking about how great they are. The guys who are stuck in Bitcoin, who for a second say, wow, you know, this might do something. That is a massive indicator.
Yeah,
sure. Travis, we were talking the other day, and I think you had a good point about it, just about like your kind of, I guess, what you've learned previously in your trading career, and just as far as kind of how you approach things and your willingness to change your mind on something. That kind of resonated with me. Would love to have you like dive into just a little bit of kind of like your mindset, because I think like how quick you are to learn and maybe adjust on the fly is probably going to be helpful to maybe a lot of other people. It's just kind of understanding more of a professional mindset than the, you know, falling in love with your favorite cryptocurrency and holding it till it goes to zero.
Can't get married to any of this stuff, Bobby. Can't get married to any of this. So you got it's way too early to even to just like be waxing poetic about like what things are like, what's going to happen 3 years from now, 4 years from now. Like it's hard to make investment decisions based on that. And like, one of the few things that I heard Steve Cohen say multiple times is, I don't live in the world. I don't make this world. I just got to live in it. And like, that's resonated with me in terms of just like, don't try and project your own view on the way that like the market should be acting like this. This is what should be happening. Just absorb information, have as good of a framework and a process as possible to absorb and synthesize that information and boil it down into, okay, what is the market telling me about the way these things are coming together? And that just strikes me as especially in an asset class as nascent as this one, it's just like you take the available information and then you make a call, but you got to be so willing to change your mind, right? It's just strong opinions weakly held. Got to be willing to change your mind when a new fact pattern emerges. So,
for sure, for sure. Anything on that end? I mean, as far as kind of your thoughts, I know there have been a few maybe assets, crypto assets that you've liked a lot, Rocco, and maybe kind of switched up on recently. Anything that like kind of drives that point home for you?
Oh yeah, completely. The rule number one, like Travis said, for anyone getting into the markets, is never fall in love. HODL is like a really dumb way to think, because you'll be hodling to zero. Make sure you take profits along the way. But speaking to that, like, you know, something can change on the dime. Like recently Zencash, because of the Equihash ASIC miners, suffered from a 51% attack. There were two double spends. The guy reorganized 30 blocks, I believe. Like, this was a very calculated attack on the network. And I was holding Zencash, and I was like, yeah, you know, later quarter three to quarter four, they're working on like block DAG structure. They're working on the treasury with IOHK. But like, as soon as I heard that, I'm out 75, you know, I sold a ton of what I had, simply because, you know what, if it's happening now, you can't fall in love with these things. You have to sell.
Yeah.
Or else you're gonna get crushed, because, you know, it's early in the market, but any big indicator of that, like a network getting attacked, unless you're the Verge community and, you know, decide
and then, you know, the and price goes like up 70%, yeah, you know, after 51% attack,
our network is 49%.
It's a positive market movement.
Yeah, exactly. But as soon as you have an indicator like that, it is time to, you know, get out. Don't fall in love with these things, because, you know, you'll be holding to zero if you think that, you know, after a huge attack like that, that it's, you know, viable for the future.
Yeah. I think along those lines about maybe changing your mind, and Rocco, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this afterwards. So the FAT protocol thesis was one of the things that there's like a list of things as I was going down the rabbit hole last summer that it, like, they sort of, as I discovered them, they like in aggregate led me to quit my job. And reading the FAT protocol thesis was one of them. I was like, dude, this is just so revolutionary relative to sort of anything else that has happened before. Just over the last few months, I've started to personally sort of step away from the FAT protocol thesis view. And it strikes me as maybe a more likely market structure is that you're going to have a few cryptocurrencies that are going to vie for global store of value, you know, digital gold. And there's reasons to look historically and think that there's probably not going to be more than like a couple of those, right? There's not going to be seven like global stores of value. That's just like not the way it's ever worked in history before. And then when you look at, you know, so putting those into a bucket, and then taking a look at the sort of protocol layers, the DAP platform, so to speak, like it seems like there's probably room for, like, I don't know, more than three and less than 10, because there's different trade-offs in terms of like you can pull a lever on governance so far before you start yanking on centralization, and you can pull, and like all these different levers that you can pull on how to build these protocols, they're all kind of interrelated, right? Or it's like on an NBA like video game, like you got like 100 points to go around, like through all your different skill sets, right? And there's only, you know, if you've got like 95 in your dunking ability, like you can only be so good in your 3-point and like that kind of thing. And so like there seems like there's going to be,
it's a great comparison. that's such a good analogy.
There's going to be room for a handful of different protocols that have their levers set at different points, where the utility tokens that are built on top of those protocols, it makes more sense for that to have that specific combination of levers. But through that, because of open source software development and the way that people can just hard fork these various different things, it feels like that's probably going to be a race to zero from a lot of these protocols, and that it's actually more likely that, because the ecosystem is starting to circle up around the fact that to create value at the protocol layer, you need transactions. But transactions, you have to have utility, like things that users are actually wanting to use. Like, my mother is never going to know about the difference between DPoS and gossip about gossip, right? But at some point, something's going to get built on top of EOS or on top of Hashgraph or on top of Ethereum that like my mom's going to use because it's like cooler than like what else is out there, right? And in the meantime, I think all these protocols may be racing to try and bring that transaction volume from the utility tokens that people are actually using onto their network, and that's going to be able to capture that value relative to sitting at the protocol.
Yeah, you're going to see it. I definitely agree kind of with, you know, the FAT protocols. It's good for now to take a look at, but in the future, it's going to be app-based.
Yeah.
So even looking at Steemit, for example, not the biggest fan of Steemit, but you look at Steemit as an application, you don't know what's happening in the background. That there, you know, there's this consent DPoS going on in the background. It's just this front-facing application that people are using, and when they transact, they are transacting on that blockchain. It just happens. That no one's going to be thinking about, you know, how we're breaking down blockchains, but rather how these applications are functioning on top of them. And to speak to that, I honestly think in the next year or two, you're going to see a mass migration of a lot of different applications to other chains, and then it'll consolidate around a handful. That, like, you know, you'll see, you know, even Ethereum application. So let's say Ethereum doesn't scale, you might have a mass migration to another chain that does scale. And again, it's not about those chains; it's about the applications being built on them, capturing value to value those chains, because it's going to go from we're sending Ethereum back and forth as, you know, obviously to send value back and forth. But the applications that are moving tokens around are all using Ethereum's chain on the back end. You're still transacting on Ethereum's chain, but the value is being given based from those applications to the chain itself. But honestly, I think, yeah, I think FAT protocols for now, but in the future, once, you know, we figure out who the winners are, we get that handful, then it's going to totally flip almost immediately. It's not going to be like a subtle thing. It's going to be like, all right, we're closing up shop and moving to this protocol, and then that's it. People forget about the protocol in the background. It still operates, still gets developed, but it's about the applications on top of it.
I agree with that. I mean, at the protocol layer, I mean, I think the price graph or the market cap graph may end up looking like a lot of value created, and then they all start going like this as it's like this like sort of race to zero across different protocols. Yeah. I agree with that. It's not to say that I don't think protocols can be great investments today and tomorrow and the rest of this year and probably 2019 as well too. And like, yeah,
exactly. And that's a hot thing with even ICOs now is most of the ICOs that are doing well are protocols, not applications. So even like, again, even though the protocol isn't even built and it's just a placeholder token, people are betting on these protocols now. Yeah. But there's going to be a wake-up call once it all consolidates, protocols figure out scaling and there's a mass migration applications, because then it becomes about the applications. Then it's this, it's the build-all phase. But like now it's simply about the protocols.
Sure. When you guys are researching and looking at things recently, what is like, has anything kind of really just captured your interest, or you've really liked that, you know, jumped down a rabbit hole on something, whether it's just how to value something, whether it's a specific project, consensus mechanism, whatever it might be. Would love to hear if there's anything recently that's just kind of caught your eye and you've really been diving into it a lot further.
For me, it's been dual token structures in the context of some types of utility tokens. And I think circling up around that concept was a product of thinking through the velocity problem and the fact that, like, at this point today, it's pretty clearly understood that velocity is a friend of value creation for crypto assets and an enemy of value capture. And that sort of all else being equal, the faster that a token spins through an ecosystem, all else being equal, the lower the price has to be to satisfy the economic demand of the overall utility of that ecosystem. And so you go, okay, well, if you're creating all this value, but you're not capturing it, like how do we bridge that gap? And it looks like dual token structures for some types of utility tokens may be the most interesting way that I've seen right now to potentially bridge that. And it basically looks like a utility token that spins fast through the ecosystem, users use it, and it creates the value of the technology as a whole. And then a security token that is used to stake to generate fees, and that staking mechanism slows down the velocity of that token and allows the value that's created by the utility token to get captured at the security token level. And then you can start trying to add on these other little, like, interesting velocity slowing mechanisms like buyback and burning, right? Like Binance has a very interesting thing. Shout out CZ for like just crushing it and continuing to push as hard as he can to bring this space, you know, into a level where it's ready for the rest of the world. But it's like, it's interesting to see something like, for example, on Binance, if you know, you get half off your fees if you pay the fees in Binance token. But like implicit in that is that you have to have enough Binance tokens sitting in your account to pay the fees in Binance to get the 50% off the fees. Well, that's like this little mechanism that slows down velocity, right? And I hope and I expect that as we keep going over the rest of this year, moving into 2019, they're going to start seeing more and more of these like little mechanisms in token structure design that help slow down velocity.
Binance has done some really interesting things with BNB, even like most recently. Like they have a pretty big referral program, and I'm part of it. And they, I think within the last week or two, are like, hey, if you, they pay 20% on fees to anybody you refer, basically, I think pretty much forever. If you hold 500 or more BNB tokens, you double that commission to 40%. So you're holding, like, at this point in time, over a Bitcoin worth of BNB tokens, but you're holding 500 in the account and you're not touching it because you're doubling your commission percentage. So interesting things like that.
So maybe just to reverse engineer this. So if CZ is putting all this stuff into his token structure for Binance that is so obviously meant to tamper velocity, like if CZ was sitting here right now, what do you think he would be saying about velocity and whether or not it's a real problem?
I think he would agree that it's a problem considering the direction they're going in. To speak to what you're saying, one of the things I'm working on now is evaluation of utility tokens. And I've kind of come up with the spectrum of appended versus intelligent and functional versus non-functional. Appended being tokens that are payment tokens that suffer from these velocity issues. And not to say that appended tokens might not have a great product. So Golem, for example, is great product, but it's a token, it's an appended token. It's a payment token, something that can be handled by Ethereum, for example, but it's going to suffer from velocity problems because it's simply being used for payments on the network. Yeah. But Binance has, like you're saying, has slowly been adding things to stop the spinning. Like even recently, one of the greatest things, they said, okay, we're becoming our own blockchain. And I'm sure they're going to introduce that, you know, how BNB exists and convert it to the main chain asset for that. Or even just stopping with the fees, having it stacked in your wallet. And you're going to see more tokens come out with these methods that were originally used for payments move toward, anything that'll stop the velocity. Like Civic, for example, came out with like some convoluted staking mechanism. Because originally it was used for payments on the network, and then they realized, oh, wait a second, we need to figure this out because, you know, we're eventually going to suffer from that value going down. You have Poet, for example, moving towards crowdsource intelligent and verifying things. It's all these tokens that were originally used for payments that are now transitioning towards these models of staking or holding the tokens down to make sure they don't suffer from velocity.
VeChain and Thor.
Yeah, you're going to see, exactly. You're going to see all these tokens who are just for payments say, wait a second, this, you know, we weren't thinking about this before. And as more people talk about velocity, it's becoming a real thing. We're going to rework these models, introduce some kind of staking. Hopefully it works. Like Enigma, for example, it was payment for a data marketplace, but then they're like, okay, you know, off-chain computation is going to require staking tokens. We're going to have data ranking based on the tokens as well for quality of data. They're all just going to introduce these models to stop the velocity, even if they exist now. So the way in which we evaluate assets now based on them being appended tokens or these payment tokens that suffer from economic velocity, we might have to rethink it as they retool their entire ecosystems.
Yep.
And one other thing I wanted to push back a little on was the dual token structure, because it could either work for you or against you. So the way you were talking about earlier, I immediately went to MakerDAO.
Yeah, I was going to say stablecoins are all using the dual token structure now, it seems like.
Yeah, exactly. So how DAI is, you know, it's pure velocity, and then Maker kind of draws back and it's like, okay, this is the governance, this is the fees, and it dictates the collateral. So value is captured in two different ways from those two tokens. But what I was thinking about recently with dual tokens was NEO. And the way NEO operates, where NEO as a governance token, you know, generates gas as a dividend and you govern the network. But gas becomes problematic when it comes to deploying smart contracts.
Yeah.
So to deploy a smart, even though it's a dual token structure, gas right now to deploy a smart contract on the NEO network is absurdly expensive. I think it's like 500 gas or something. And the way gas moves as an asset right now, it's just, I don't know, how do you reconcile with that? You know, because of that model, you're unable to really.
I think that you need to build into your token economics a manner in which the utility of the token, the price of that utility stays like relatively constant or like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I've seen a lot of projects go towards the second token being a stable coin. So even I think Grid Plus, their second token, I think it's Volt or something. It's supposed to be a stable coin.
Yeah.
Just to capture that velocity while the other one acts in a different way.
Well, and just to, you know, we can go down the stable coins is like a separate 90-minute discussion.
Yeah. Right?
but I mean, I think if like a basis or something like that ends up taking off and working, I think there's a really good chance that like for a lot of these, you just end up seeing that being the utility token that spins through the ecosystem, and then your security token, like it replaces the utility token. You don't need it anymore. And you start having these staking mechanisms that, and you just earn the stable coin. And it's like, now you're talking like probably 3, 4, 5 years down the road. But again, it's like, you ask yourself the question, like why is it exactly that I need a native token for that particular ecosystem? And if there's not a compelling reason for it to not be thought of as more working capital, then it's working capital. And, you know, multi-billion dollar corporations spend tens of millions of dollars every year to try as hard as they can to minimize their working capital, because nobody wants to do that. And like, and John Pfeffer's talked about this, right? Shout out to the Godfather, John Pfeffer, right? Done incredibly interesting work. But how much gas do you have in your car? How much food do you have in your fridge? And how much cash do you have in your wallet? You got like half a tank of gas. You got like half, a fridge of food. And I got like $40 in my wallet, because like all of that, you know, it's there whenever you need it. And you can just call, I can go to a gas station whenever I want to. I can go to the ATM whenever I need to. And like on a day-to-day basis, I minimize that. And so there's a potential for stable coins to come in and just clear out all of these utility tokens that end up looking too much like working capital.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I differentiated with that spectrum, where an appended token is something that could be done away with, for example, a stable coin or the native protocol asset. Whereas intelligent design is, this token is integral to this system. The system cannot function without the token, and it's done in a way in which it's seamless.
Yep.
For sure. Yeah, that I think that's a really good point. And there's a lot of, I think one thing that you had mentioned too, and kind of like going to the nascency of the space, is like the adaptability of some of these tokens and kind of how they came out. And hey, we're just going to be a payment mechanism for our, you know, for our DApp. And it's, you realize that hey, that's not necessary at all, and there has to be some other element to the token structure and to how it functions within the ecosystem to actually create some value and capture value. And you're seeing companies out there, like you had mentioned, Rocco, kind of changing that up to try and capture more value in the long run and just try to bring utility to the token other than just doing something that Ethereum or that ETH could have easily done.
Yeah,
because I'm afraid for the future of some of these guys, and you'll see whichever project is intelligent thinking about this will, if they were originally an appended token or a payment token, will modify what they're doing. You could always add on features to a token. And the ones who are really thinking about it will do that. There's no doubt about it.
Totally.
And again, not to plug the Ike guy strategy too much, but like all these conversations that you're having, that's why I like this like hodling shit, or this like, oh, I'm just going to buy the top 10 and like just sit there and sort of wait. Like, it's like you have to have an active portfolio management strategy so that you can go and deploy capital as these tectonic plates are shifting, right? And there's these changes that are happening. It's going to continue to happen. Those foundational building blocks of this ecosystem are not set in stone yet. And again, in terms of like why you need to be looking at the venture stage side of this ecosystem, it helps you inform your view of the liquid crypto assets. Cause like, I can't really have a view on Ethereum, you know, without having a view on EOS. And I can't really have a fully informed view on Ethereum and EOS unless I have a pretty good view of Hashgraph, right? And so it's like, you need to be able to have a look at that entire value chain and understand how those pieces are coming together and moving along through time.
Yeah. And I think with that kind of valuation, that could be definitely applied on protocols. But as for, and I, I to push back also, I think as when we think about currencies, I think a more conservative approach could be taken, where you could look like recently, you know, deploying a conservative strategy. If you're picking up Bitcoin, Monero, and Decred, you know what they are, what they currently do, and what they're setting out to do, whereas the protocols are a little more mystifying. They're still building what they're doing. But when it operates, you know, as this currency, it knows it's a currency and it's successful at it so far, you could be a bit more conservative with that kind of strategy.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. But I would just say that as a fiduciary, like, I'm not really in the mood to take a 65% draw over 100 in the face. Right. So like, you want to build a system of processes and tools that can help you miss some of that. So,
yeah,
totally. Maybe we can just finish off. If there's anything, any topics that I didn't cover, anything that you guys want to leave off with, we can kind of dive in and end with that. If there's anything specifically, maybe a topic I didn't cover, anything you want to talk to people about at this point?
I think that one thing is, you know, what's holding back, not institutions, but traditional investors, like the average Joe, from kind of getting into the market, besides the learning curve. And I just want to, with that, I think that Circle and Robinhood, as much as they're easy to trash on, are kind of taking the right approach with, you can't take the asset. I believe for those two, you can't take the asset off the exchanges themselves, that you're simply just trading them on there. And I think
Robinhood's eventual plan is to allow you to, but I think initially speaking, yeah, you can't remove, it's basically, yeah, you can buy and sell, but you can't actually remove it from the app.
Yeah. And I think taking steps like that might be a safer bet for getting the average Joe into the markets, because they can get a taste of it. They don't have to, you know, they're taking care of the custody end. They don't have to worry about the asset leaving the actual exchange. But again, I think it just comes down to the learning curve as well in this space. People don't understand what they're investing in, so they might not be as eager to take the step. When you have a market like it is right now, when you have the media hype, it's very easy because everyone's telling you, look how, you know, people are becoming millionaires. But like now, when it's calmer, you know, services like that, I think, are very important to take a look at for these guys who are like, okay, the smoke is cleared. I want to really take a look at this. And as a first step, it's very easy to do so.
For sure.
Yeah. This is a difficult space to try and think about what retail participation should look like from an investment perspective. Now, you know, when they start using these things for what they're meant to be used for, then that gets more interesting or more manageable. But I guess it's like, I can easily spend 60 hours a week trading, and I can easily spend 60 hours a week going through research. I can spend 60 hours a week talking to other ecosystem participants about what's going on, and like, okay, there's 180 hours a week, right? And so it does, you know, take a significant amount of time to commit to fully understanding the space. But from a day-to-day retail perspective, the asset class isn't going anywhere. I mean, this is the millennial generation internet. It is. I'm positive about it. This is our internet. And so, you know, sooner rather than later, again, do your own research, read about it, and, you know, ask people that know more than you do. There's a wealth of information publicly available. I mean, there wasn't the internet to talk about the internet when the internet was invented. And now we have the internet to talk about it. We've got to wade through a lot of stuff, but it's like, you know, like hop on my Twitter and look at the list of guys that I follow and start following them. There's some great thought leaders, and going through Medium and this, that, and the other. And you know, it's going to be an incredibly exciting ride over the next, you know, really couple decades. So, not going anywhere.
It's like, even the stuff we know that's simple, like a coin versus a platform versus a token, we could easily say, like, you know, look at Bitcoin, Ethereum, and then Augur, because we know the difference between all of them. Even if something as simple as that, a retail investor would not know the difference of when they first come in.
Yeah. Sure. Totally. Well, I appreciate the time, guys. I will put links to your Twitter profiles and where everybody can find you in the YouTube description, the podcast description, if you're listening on the podcast. But really do appreciate the time. And if there are any questions, feel free to sound off in the comments below on YouTube. And like I said, I'll have the links to everything. But hope you guys have a good one. Appreciate all the thoughts and commentary, man.
Yeah. No, thank you, Ben. Rocco, Bobby, pleasure.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.